be exhausted.
I actually discorporated at this full-on assault of thought. My freaking spirit body spread out into a giant puffy cloud of vaguely Dresden-colored mist. And it hurt. I mean, that's the only word I can think of that really applies. It wasn't like any kind of pain I'd felt before, and I'm a connoisseur when it comes to pain. It wasn't pain of the body, the way I had known it. It was more like the way your head feels when you hear or see an image or concept that flabbergasts you so hard that the only thing you can say about it is, "That is so wrong." That times a million. And not just in my head, but full body. It took a full minute for that feeling to fade, and it was only then that I could see myself coming back together again. "Don't explain," I said almost desperately, when I looked up to see eternal silence hovering a little closer to me. "Don't! That hurt!" It waited. "We have to keep this simple," I stuttered, thinking out loud, "or you're going to kill me. Again." I pressed the heel of my hand against my forehead and said, "I'm going to ask yes or no questions," I said. "For yes, stay silent. For no, indicate otherwise. Agreed?" Nothing. Eternal silence might not have even been there, except that his cloak kept rolling and billowing, lava lamp fashion. "Is your cloak red?" The hood of the cloak twitched left and right once. "Fantastic," I muttered. "Communication." I mopped at my face with my hands and said, "Okay. When you say everyone, are you talking like everyone I know?" Twitch. "More than that?" Silence. "The whole city?" Twitch. "What? More?" Silence. "So, you mean, like, everyone. Everyone. The whole planet." Silence. "And me, understanding my freaking path, saves them." Silence. Twitch. "Great," I muttered. "Next, you'll want me to take a pebble out of your hand." Twitch. "I wasn't being literal." "Okay, yeah, you and I aren't going to communicate well this way." Silence. Somehow emphatic. I stopped and pondered for a moment, then I said, "Wait, this is connected, isn't it, with what Captain Murphy sent me to do?" Silence. "Find my killer?" I asked him. "I don't get it. How does finding my killer save the world?" The deep voice repeated earlier phrases. "You must understand your path. It is more than necessary. It is essential to survival."
There's a little irony in eternal silence being stuck on a looping soundbite, I sighed. A wraith's moan drifted into the air, and I tensed, looking around. One of those ragged scarecrow shapes was rising from the earth of a grave, like something being hauled up out of deep mud. It moaned in mindless hunger, its eyes vacant. Then there was another moan, and another. Wraiths were coming up out of graves all around me. I started breathing harder, though I didn't need to.
"Yeah, okay. Brilliant idea for a safe house, Harry. It's a freaking graveyard. Where else are ghosts going to be?"
Eternal silence only stared at me. There was an amused quality to its silence. "I have to go," I said.
"Is that all you had for me? Understand my path?"
Silence. It lifted a green shrouded limb in a gesture of farewell. The first wraith finished with what was evidently its nightly routine of slogging out of the earth and moaning. Its empty eyes turned toward me, and it began to drift my way, immaterial toes dangling down through the snow. "Screw this," I said and vanished. One, two, three hops, and I was to the nearest brick wall of the cemetery. I gritted my teeth and plunged into it. and slammed my face into cold stone. Pain lanced through my nose, and I snarled at my own stupidity. Damn it, Harry. Walls are built to keep things out, but walls around graveyards are built to keep things in. I'd known that since I was a freaking kid. I checked behind me. The wraiths were drifting after me in a slow, graceful horde, adding members as they went. They weren't fast, but there were dozens and dozens of them. Again, I was reminded of documentaries I'd seen showing giant clouds of jellyfish. I gritted my teeth and thought fast. When walls are built, they are intended as physical barriers. As a result of that intention, invested by dozens or scores of builders, they took on a similar solidity when it came to the spiritual as well. It's why they held most ghosts inside graveyards. And it probably had something to do with the way a threshold formed around a home, too. But where human intention had created a barrier, that same intention had also created an access point. I turned and began vanishing in a line straight for the gates of the boneyard. I don't know what I would have done if they would have been closed. Shut gates and shut doors carry their own investment of intention, just as the walls do. But open gates are another matter entirely, and the gates of Graceland stood wide open. As I went through them, I looked back at what seemed like a modest-sized army of wraiths heading for the opening. I had a light bulb moment. The gates of the cemetery were being left open, and hordes of wraiths haunted the streets of Chicago by night lately. "Aha, Morty," I said. "And now we know where they're coming from." Someone alive, was opening those gates at night. That meant that we had a place to begin, a trail we could attempt to follow to find out who was stirring up the city's spooks to use against Morty, and why. I had information. I had something to trade Mort for his ongoing help. I suddenly felt like an investigator again. "Hot diggity dog," I said, grinning. "The game's a frickin' foot." Chapter 15. I revved up the memory and started jumping. It was a quick way to travel in the city. The ability to go over buildings and ignore traffic signals, one-way streets, and cars was a real plus. It didn't take me long to get to Mortimer's house. It was on fire. There were fire trucks there, lights blazing. The firemen were moving quickly, professionally, but though the house was well ablaze, they only had one hose up and running. As I stood there staring, two more started up, but I knew it was a lost cause. Morty's place was burning even more swiftly and brightly than mine had, or maybe the dark was just making it look that way. A cop or two showed up as the firemen kept the blaze from spreading to the houses around it. Not hard, given the snow on the ground. Blue lights from the bubbles on the cop cars joined the red and yellow of the CFD. People stood around watching the fire. In my experience, they often do. Of course, they didn't usually do it out in the cold, and they didn't usually do it in 6 inches of snow, and they tended to wander off when the fire began to subside, and talk, and blink, and their clothing is generally from the current century. The crowd of onlooking Chicago civilians were ghosts. I walked among them, looking at faces. They were much like any other group of folks, apart from the period outfits. I recognized a few from Sir Stewart's Home Defense Brigade, but only a few, and they were more recent shades. The rest were just people, men, women, and children. A boy, maybe 10 years old, was the only shade who seemed to notice me. Beside him stood a girl who must have been about 7 when she died. They were holding hands. He looked up at me as I passed by, and I stopped to stare down at him. "Where do we go now?" he asked. "I don't know another place to go." I said, "I don't know either. Hey, did you see what happened?" "It came back again tonight. Then men came with fire. They burned the house. They took the little man away." I stiffened. "The gray ghost took Mort?" No, men took him, the boy said. The girl said, in a soft little voice, We used to play with other children by the river, but he brought us here. He was always nice to us. Her facial expression never changed. It was flat, empty. The boy sighed, touched the little girl's shoulder, and turned back to stare at the dwindling flames. I stood there watching them for a moment, and could see them growing more visibly transparent. I checked the other shades. It was happening to them, too, to a greater or lesser degree. Hey, I said to the boy, do you know Sir Stuart? The big man, the soldier, the boy said, nodding. He's in the garden behind the house. Thank you, I said, and went to look, vanishing to the side of Mort's house, and then jumping again to the garden. Mort's backyard was like his front, sculpted, carefully maintained, decorated with Japanese sensibilities, spare and elegant. There was what looked like a koi pond, now filled with snow. There were trees and more of the little bonsai pieces, delicate and somehow vulnerable. The fire had been close enough and hot enough to melt any coating of snow from their little branches. What was left of Sir Stuart lay in a circle in the snow. They'd used fire. A perfect circle was melted in the snow, out toward the back of the yard. They'd used gasoline, it looked like. The snow was melted down all the way to the scorched grass. Alcohol burns about 3 times as hot as gas, and faster, and it melts the snow fast enough for water to drown the flame. Someone had used the fire as part of a circle trap, pretty standard for dealing with spirits and other heavily supernatural entities. Once trapped in a circle, a spirit was effectively helpless, unable to leave, and unable to exercise power through its barrier. The devilish part of the trap was the fire. Fire's real, even to spirits, and brings pain to the immaterial as fast as it does to flesh and blood creatures. That's one huge reason I always used fire in my mortal career. Fire burns, period. Even practically invulnerable things don't like dealing with fire. There was maybe half of Sir Stuart left. Most of his upper body was there, and part of his right arm. His legs were mostly gone. There wasn't any blood. What was left of him looked like a roll of papers rescued from a fire. The edges were blackened and crumbling slowly away. The horrible part was that I knew he was still alive. Or what passed for being alive among ghosts. Otherwise, he would simply be gone. Did he feel pain? I knew that if I were in his condition, I would. Sure, maybe I knew that there was no spoon, but when it came down to it, I wasn't sure I could deny that much apparent reality. Or maybe the memory of pain wasn't an issue. Maybe the weird form of pain eternal silence had showed me had some sort of spiritual analog, or maybe fire being fire, he was just in very real, very familiar agony. I shuddered. Not that I could do anything about it. The circle that trapped him would keep me out as easily as it kept him in. In theory, I could take it down, but only if I could physically move something across it to break its continuity. I looked around quickly and spotted a twig standing out of the snow a few feet away. All I would need to do was move it about 3 feet. It was like trying to eat broth with a fork. I just couldn't get hold of the stick. My hand went through it, time and time again, no matter what I tried. I couldn't even get the damn thing to wiggle. I wasn't ghost enough to help Sir Stuart. Not like that, anyway. Sir Stuart, I asked quietly. I could see only one of his eyes. It half opened. Hmm? I squatted down on my heels next to the circle. It's Harry Dresden.
Dresden,
he slurred, and his mouth turned up in a faint smile.
Pardon me if I don't rise. Perhaps it was something I ate.
Of course, I said. What happened?
I was a fool, he said. Our attacker came at the same time every night. I made the mistake of assuming that was true because it was as soon as the attacker could assemble his forces.
The Grey Ghost, I said. Sir Stuart grunted.
Arrived at dusk. Sooner than I would have dared the open air. No mob of spirits this time. It came with half a dozen mortals, and they set the house on fire. I was able to get Mortimer out of the house in time, but they'd set a trap for me in the backyard.
One hand gestured at the circle within which he lay.
He was taken at the command of the Grey Ghost.
I frowned. These mortals, they could hear the Grey Ghost?
Aye,
Sir Stuart said.
Stars and stones, I growled. I could barely get two people in Chicago to hear me.
This joker has half a dozen? How? Sir Stuart shook his head faintly.
Would that I knew.
We'll find Morty, I said. Let me figure out how to get you out of there, and then we'll go find him. He opened his eyes fully and focused on me for the first time.
No,
he said in a gentle voice.
I won't.
Come on, I said. Don't talk like that. We'll get you patched up. Sir Stuart let out a small laugh.
Nay, wizard. Too much of me has been lost. I've only held together this long, so that I could speak to you.
What happened to our world being mutable in time with our expectations? Isn't that still true?
To a degree,
Sir Stuart said affably, weakly.
I've been injured before. Small hurts are restored simply enough.
He gestured at his broken body.
But this? I'll be like the others when I restore myself.
The others?
The warriors who defended Mortimer's home, he said. They faded over time, forgetting little by little about their mortal lives.
I thought about the soldiers I'd seen battling the enemy shades and wraiths, silent, severe, seemingly disconnected from the world around them. They'd fought loyally and ably enough, but I was willing to bet that they couldn't remember why they did so or who they were fighting. I imagined Sir Stuart like the rest of them, a translucent outline, his empty eyes focused on something else entirely, always faithful, always silent. I shivered. It could happen to me, too.
Listen to me, boy, Sir Stuart said. We didn't trust you. We assumed you were mixed up in whatever it is the Grey Ghost wanted.
Like hell, I said.
You don't know that,
Sir Stuart said flatly.
For all we knew, you could have been directed by that creature without your own knowledge. For that matter, you don't have the feel of a normal ghost. It could have created you whole from the spirit world.
I scowled and began to argue, and couldn't. I'd been faced with the odd and unusual, and had drawn incorrect conclusions too many times. When people are scared, they don't think straight. Mort had been terrified.
Do you still think that? I asked. No reason for you to be here if you were,
Sir Stuart said.
The worst has happened. Were you a plant, you would not have come. Though I suppose you might still be a dupe.
Thanks, I said wryly. He softened the words with another smile.
But, dupe or not, it may be that ye can help Mortimer. And it is critical that you do so. Without his influence, this city will be in terrible danger.
Yeah, you aren't exactly increasing the tension by telling me that, I said. We're already sort of playing for maximum stakes.
I know not what you mean, Sir Stuart replied. But I tell you this. Those shades standing around the house, one and all, are murderers.
I blinked and looked back at the still smoldering house and at the enormous circle of spirits around it.
Each and every one of them, Sir Stuart said.
Mortimer gave them something they needed to turn aside from the madness.
A home. If you do not restore him to freedom so that he may care for these poor souls, they will kill again. As sure as the sun rises, they won't be able to help themselves.
He exhaled wearily and closed his eyes.
50 years of maddened shades unleashed upon this city all at once, preying on mortals. Blood will run in buckets.
I stared at him for a moment. Then I said,
How am I supposed to do that?
I've not the foggiest,
Sir Stuart replied. He fumbled at his belt and drew that monster pistol. He paused for a moment, grimacing. Then he tossed it weakly at my feet. It tumbled through the circle with a flicker of energies and landed atop the snow without sinking into it, the apparition of a weapon. I stared for a second. A spirit couldn't project its power across a circle, and I was sure that power was exactly what the gun represented. So if it had crossed the circle's barrier, it meant that it was power that no longer belonged to Sir Stuart. On several levels, what he had just done was a violent act of self-mutilation, like chopping off your own hand. He gestured weakly toward the gun and said,
"Take it."
I picked it up gingerly. It weighed a ton. What am I going to do with this?
Help Mortimer, he replied.
His shape began to flicker and fade at the edges.
I'm sorry that I couldn't do more. Couldn't teach you more.
He opened his eyes again and leaned toward me, his expression intent.
Memories, Dresden. Their power. Their weapons. Make from your memory a weapon against them.
His voice lost its strength and his eyes sagged closed.
3 centuries of playing guardian. But I failed my trust. Redeem my promise. Please. Help Mortimer. Yes, I said quietly. I will.
That faint smile appeared again, and Sir Stuart nodded once. Then he let out his breath in a sigh. He faded even more, and as I watched, his limbs simply renewed themselves, appearing as his shape became more translucent. The damage reversed itself before my eyes. A moment later, he sat up. He looked around, his gaze passing right through me. Then he paused and stared at the ruined house, his brow furrowed in puzzled concentration, an expression mirrored on the faces of most of the spirits present. Sir Stuart was nowhere to be seen in the shade's hollow eyes. I bowed my head and clenched my teeth, cursing. I had liked the guy, just like I had liked Morty, whatever insults I may have offered him. I was angry about what happened to him, and I was angry about the position he had put me in. Now I was the one responsible for somehow finding and helping Morty, when I could barely communicate with anyone without him. All while the bad guy, whatever the hell it was, apparently got to chat it up with its own flunkies at will. I couldn't touch anything. I couldn't make anything happen. My magic was gone. And now not only was I to track down my own murderer, but I had to rescue Mort Lindquist as well. Fabulous. Maybe I should make it my new slogan. Harry Dresden. I take responsibility for more impossible situations in the first 24 hours of being dead than most people do all day. More snow was beginning to fall. Eventually it would break the circle that had trapped what was left of Sir Stuart. Though I didn't know where he would go to take shelter from the sunrise. Maybe he would just know the way I had seemed to, some kind of post-death survival instinct. Or maybe he wouldn't. Either way, it didn't seem like there was much I could do about it, and I hated that fact with a burning passion. Sir Stuart and the other spirits needed Morty Lindquist. Before I died, I might have been Harry Dresden, wizard at large. Now I was Harry Dresden, immaterial messenger boy, persuader and wheedler. I desperately wanted to blow something into tiny, tiny pieces and then disintegrate the pieces. All things considered, it was probably not the best frame of mind in which to handle a confrontation in a rational, diplomatic manner.
"Aha," said a whispery, oily voice behind me. "She was right. The Tall One returns." "Look at him," said another voice, higher pitched and inhuman. "He will make such a meal." "Our orders are orders," said a third voice, filled with scorn. "She's not here.
We shall share him, the three of us, and none shall be the wiser. Agreed,
said the second voice eagerly. After a pause, the first voice said,
Agreed.
I turned and saw three of the dark-robed forms from the night before during the attack on Casa Lindquist, lemurs. Their clothing stirred with lazy aquatic fluidity at the touch of an immaterial wind. From this close, I could see the faint images of pale faces inside their hoods and the sheen of gleaming, hungry eyes.
Take him, said the first lemur.
And three of the hungriest old ghosts of Chicago blurred toward the new guy. Chapter 16 The lemurs pounced, and I vanished, straight up. I stood in empty air, 100 feet above them, furious, and called down, You mooks! Picked a really lousy time to start up with me! Hooded heads searched upward, but I was an indistinct shape in a darkened sky already blurred by snow, while they were sharp outlines against a field of white. I started throwing a punch, vanished again, and reappeared right behind lemur number one. My fist drove into the base of his neck just as I shouted, BAMF! There isn't much honor in a rabbit punch, but it's a pretty darn good way to down an opponent. Whatever rules govern the world of spirit, there must have been some kind of analog to a human nervous system. The lemur let out a choking gasp and fell to the ground as the other two panicked at the sudden assault and vanished. I kicked the down guy in the head and neck a few times to help him on his way to analog concussion land, screaming in pure and incoherent rage all the while. I had a fraction of a second's warning, a cold breath on the back of my neck, a rippling wave of ethereal pressure against my back. I vanished to reappear 5 feet behind my original position, and this time I meant to be facing the same way when I arrived. I got there in time to see one of the other lemurs swing a freaking hatchet at the space my skull had recently vacated. He stumbled off balance from the miss, and I kicked his ass, literally. I leaned my upper body back a bit and pretended I was using my heel to stomp an aluminum can flat. It's a powerful kick, especially with my full body weight behind it, and the lemur flew forward and into the snow.
Who's the man?
I screamed at the sprawled lemurs, fear and anger and excitement pitching my voice about an octave higher than usual.
Who's the man?
The hood had fallen from the face of the second, and an unremarkable man of middle age goggled at me in complete incomprehension, which made sense. Who knew how many decades of pop culture the lemurs had missed out on? They probably never even heard of Will Smith. I am completely unappreciated in my time, I muttered. I am also, apparently, no wizard when it comes to simple mathematics. While I was Will Smithing, lemur number three appeared out of nowhere and smashed a baseball bat against the side of my neck. The pain was something incredible, more than merely the reaction of physical trauma that I would have expected from such a blow. It also encompassed an almost Olympian sense of nausea combined with a force five storm of whirling confusion. I felt myself note idly that I guessed egos literally could be bruised. It took me another second or two after that to realize that I was floating, drifting sideways and slightly upward, my body at a 45-degree diagonal to the ground. There was a roaring sound in my head. An eerie cry of triumph and hunger pealed through the night. Then the lemurs came for me. I felt bitterly cold fingers seize me, clamping down like steel claws. I was hauled out to horizontal by frigid, steely hands. I was still disoriented. I was barely able to turn my head enough to see the third lemur approach. Her hood had fallen back. She was a young woman of unexceptional appearance, neither beautiful nor displeasing. Her eyes, though, were dark and hollow, and a hideous emptiness lay behind them. She stared intently at me for a long beat, her body quivering in some kind of dark rapture. Then she let out a slow hiss, sank her fingers into the flesh of my left biceps, and ripped off a handful of meat. Ectoplasmic blood flew. My blood.
It scattered through the air in lazy globules that, once they were a few feet from me, fell like raindrops to the surface of the snow. It hurt. I screamed. All three lemurs screamed with me, as if triggered into a response by my own cries. The female lemur lifted the gobbet of flesh aloft in triumph, then held it over her open mouth and squeezed. More blood pattered out onto her lips and tongue, and she let out a gasp of unadulterated ecstasy before shoving the raw flesh into her mouth as though she hadn't eaten in weeks. Her eyes rolled back into her head. She shuddered.
"Oh," she breathed. "Pain. He's felt so much pain and rage and joy. Oh, this one lived." "Here," said the second lemur. "Come, take his legs. My turn."
The female bared her bloodied teeth at him and tore another smaller piece from my arm. She snapped it up and then leaned on my legs, pinning them. The second lemur looked me over like a man perusing a side of beef. Then he ripped a handful of flesh from my right thigh. It went like that for several minutes, with the three of them taking turns, ripping meat from my body. I won't bore you with the details. I don't like to think about it. They were stronger than me, better than me, more experienced than me when it came to spiritual conflict. They got me. The monsters got me. And it hurt. Until footsteps crunched toward us through the snow. The lemurs never took notice. I was in too much agony to care very much, but I wasn't exactly busy, either. I looked up and saw a lone figure slogging my way through the thick snow. He wasn't very big, and he was dressed in a white parka and white ski pants, with one of those ninja cap mask things, also white, covering his face. In his right hand he carried a big old-style, heavy, portable spotlight, the kind with a plastic carrying handle on top. Its twin incandescent bulbs shone a garish orange over the snow. I sniggered to myself. He was a person. He sank into the snow with every step. He wouldn't be able to see what was happening right in front of him. No wonder the lemurs paid him no mind. But 10 feet away from me, he abruptly froze in his tracks and blurted, "Holy crap!" He reached up and ripped off the ninja hood, revealing the thin, fine features of a man of somewhere near 40. His hair was dark, curly, and mussed from the hood. He had glasses perched askew on his beak of a nose, and his dark eyes were wide with shock.
"Harry?"
I stared at him and said, through the blood, "Butters?"
"Stop them," Butters hissed. "Save him. I release you for this task."
"On it, Sahib,"
shouted another voice. A cloud of campfire sparks poured out of the two sources of light in the spotlight, rushing out by the millions and congealed into a massive, man-like shape. It let out a lion's roar and blurred toward the lemurs. Two of them were sharp enough to realize something dangerous was coming, and they promptly vanished. The third, the young woman, was in the middle of another bite, and she didn't look up until it was too late. The light form hit the lemur and simply disintegrated it. As I watched, skin and clothing and flesh were ripped away from the evil spirit, as swiftly and savagely as if peeled off with a sandblaster. A heartbeat later, there was nothing left but a gently drifting cloud of sparks, speckled here and there with the floating shapes of somewhat larger, prismatic gemstones. The light being looked up, and then promptly split into two parts, each one becoming a comet that hurtled into the night sky. There was an explosion almost at once, and the raining bits and pieces of a second lemur came drifting lazily down through the night air, along with more multicolored gems. There was a terrible howling sound in the night sky above. I heard the flap of heavy robes snapping with rapid motion. The second comet of light darted back and forth, evidently engaged in some kind of aerial combat, and then lemur and comet both came hurtling back down. They struck Earth with a thunder that shook the ground while leaving the snow untouched. The orange lights flowed together into a man-like shape again, this time straddling the lemur's prone form. The being of light rained blows down on the lemur's head, over and over, striking with the speed and power of a motor's pistons. Within 10 or 12 seconds, the head of the lemur had been crushed into ectoplasmic guck, and his sparkles of light, his memories, and the same odd, tiny gems began to well up from his broken form. The light being rose from the form of the fallen lemur and scanned the area around us, his featureless face turning in a slow, alert scan.
"What the hell?" Butters said, his eyes wide. "I mean, what the hell was that, man?"
"Relax, Sahib," said a young man's voice.
It was coming from the fiery figure, which nodded and made hand-dusting motions of unmistakable satisfaction.
"Just taking out the trash. Scum like that are all over these old mortal cities. Part of the post-human condition, you might say."
I just watched. I didn't feel like doing anything else.
"Yeah, yeah," Butters said. "But he's safe now."
"For now," the being said. "And as far as I know."
Butters crunched through the snow and stared down at me. The little guy was one of Chicago's small number of medical examiners, a forensic investigator who analyzed corpses and found out all sorts of details about them. A few years ago, he'd analyzed corpses of vampires that had burned to death in a big fire someone started. He'd asserted that they obviously were not human. He'd been packed off to an institution for half a year in response. Now he treaded carefully in his career, or at least he had when I was last alive.
"Is it really him?" Butters asked.
The being of light scanned me with unseen eyes.
"I can't spot anything that would suggest he was anything else," he said cautiously. "Which ain't the same as saying it's Harry's ghost. It has more something than other ghosts I've encountered."
Butters frowned.
"More what?"
"Something," the being said.
"Meaning I'm not sure what.
Something I'm not expert in, clearly."
The ghost," Butters said. "It's hurt?"
"Quite severely," the being said.
"But it's easily mended, if you wish to do it."
Butters blinked at him.
"What? Yes, of course, I wish it." "Very good, Sahib," the being said.
And then it whipped and darted through the night air, gathering up all the floating, glittering gems from the vanishing remains of the lemurs. It brought them together into a single mass and then knelt down next to my head.
"Bob," I said quietly.
Bob the Skull, formerly my personal assistant and confidant, hesitated beside me as I said his name. Once again, I became aware of his intense regard, but if he saw anything, it didn't register on his featureless face.
"Harry," he said, "open up. You need to restore these memories to your essence."
"Restore what?" I asked.
"Eat 'em,"
Bob said firmly.
"Open your mouth."
I was tired and confused, so it was easier to just do as he said. I closed my eyes as he dropped the mass of gems into my open mouth, but instead of feeling hard gems, fresh, cool water flowed into my mouth, swirling over my parched tongue and throat as I eagerly swallowed it down. Pain vanished instantly. The disorientation began to fade and disappear. My confusion and weariness followed those others within a moment, and a deep breath later, I was sitting up in place, feeling more or less as sane and together as I had been when I had woken up that evening. Bob offered me a hand, and I took it. He pulled me to my feet as if I'd weighed less than nothing.
"Well," he said, "at least you don't seem to be a bad copy. I was half afraid you'd be some kind of demented winter night wannabe, with an eye patch and a goatee or something."
I said, "thank you."
"De nada," Bob said.
"Bob," Butters said in a firm voice, "you've fulfilled your task."
Bob the Skull sighed and turned to bow in a florid gesture of courtesy toward Butters, before dissolving into a cloud of orange sparks again and flowing back toward the flashlight. I saw then that the spotlight casing hadn't contained light bulbs and batteries and such, just Bob's skull, a human bone artifact of a long-dead enchanter who had built it as a haven that could harbor the essence of a spiritual being. "Hey, Bob," I said, "could you relay my voice to Butters?"
"Don't have to, former boss," Bob said cheerfully.
on account of the fact that Butters is a whole heck of a lot more talented at magical theory than you.
I frowned.
What? Oh, he doesn't have a lick of magical talent, Bob assured me. But he's got a brain, which, let's face it, hasn't always been your most salient feature. Bob,
Butters said in a scolding tone. Then he fumbled in his parka's pocket and produced a small, old radio.
Here, see? I had Bob go over your notes from the nightmare case, Harry. Bob said you created a radio that he could communicate through, so... I refrained from hitting my own head with the heel of my hand, but just barely.
So it wasn't much of a trick to turn it into a baby monitor. You just needed an old crystal radio. Butters listened with his head tilted toward the radio and nodded.
I explained the concept to Molly this morning, and she put it together in an hour.
He waved the spotlight housing Bob's skull.
And I can see spooks by the light of the spirit's form. So I can see and hear you. Hi.
I stared at the skinny man and didn't know if I wanted to break out into laughter or wild sobs.
Butters, you figured this all out on your own?
Well, no. I mean, I had a tutor.
He bobbled the spotlight meaningfully.
Ah, don't make me puke, Bob warned him. You won't like me when I puke.
Hush, Bob, said Butters and I in exactly the same tone at exactly the same time. We both turned to eye each other for a moment. He might have tucked the skull close to his side in a protective gesture of possession. You shouldn't stay here with all the official types around, I said.
Just thinking the same thing, Butters said. Come with me?
Sure, I said. Where?
Headquarters, he said.
From Butters's other pocket, there was a hiss and a squawk from what proved to be a long-range walkie-talkie. He picked it up, looked at something on its little display, and said,
Eyes here.
We've got nothing at his old place, said Murphy's tired voice. What about you, Eyes?
He's standing right here, talking to me, Butters said,
and not without a trace of pride. It looked good on him.
Outstanding, Eyes, Murphy said, her voice brightening with genuine pleasure. I'm sending you some shadows. Bring him in right away.
Wilco, Butters said. Out.
He put the radio away, beaming to himself. Eyes? I asked him.
Daniel kind of gave me the nickname, he said. They kept putting me on watch, and he wanted to know why they kept making the four-eyed guy our lookout. It stuck as my handle. Except we have six eyes, Bob the Skull said. I tried to get him to get me a pair of glasses, and then we'd have eight. Like spiders.
I nodded, suddenly understanding. You still work for the morgue? Butters smiled.
There are plenty of people listening to our transmissions. Murphy wouldn't let me use my name.
Murphy is smart, I said.
Extremely, Butters said, nodding agreement. She gave Bob to you? She did, he said. You, being dead and all. She wanted to keep it neat to know.
It doesn't upset me, I said, even though it sort of did. I entrusted those things to her judgment.
Oh, hey, great segue. Speaking of judgment, you'd better come with me.
I can do that, I said, and fell into pace beside him. Where are we going?
The Batcave, he said. Headquarters.
Headquarters of what? I asked. He blinked at me.
The Alliance, of course. The Chicago Alliance.
I lifted my eyebrows. What Chicago Alliance?
The one he organized to help defend the city from the Fomor,
Butters replied. He? I asked. Fomor? What he? He who?
I'm sorry, Harry, he said.
He bit his lip and looked down.
I figured you knew. Marcone. Baron John Marcone.
Chapter 17. I found Stu's pistol on the ground where I dropped it during the struggle. Then I followed Butters to his car, an old Plymouth Roadrunner. It looked almost worse than my old VW Beetle had the last time I'd seen it. Dents and dings covered its all-steel frame, and some of them looked suspiciously like they'd been raked into the metal with a two-pronged claw. But its engine throbbed with impressive, harmonious power. Its license plates read, Meep, Meep.
I kind of traded in my old one, Butters told me as I got in, going straight through the door. I didn't make any noise about the discomfort. Not in front of Butters. It would totally blow my ghostly cool. For another old one, I said. My voice issued out of the radio. He slipped into a clip attached to the car's sun visor. I like steel better than fiberglass, he said. The Fomor and the fairies are apparently related. Neither one of them likes the touch of any metal with iron in it.
Bob's skull rested in a container that had been custom-mounted on the Roadrunner's dash, a wooden frame set on a plate that made the skull wobble back and forth like a bobblehead doll.
A lot of interbreeding there, Bob said, back in the old days, before the She-Wars.
I lifted my eyebrows. I haven't heard much about it.
Crazy stuff, Bob said with tremendous enthusiasm. Even before my time, when I've heard all kinds of stories. The Dinoshi, the Tiwatha, the Fomor, the Telwith Taig, the Shen, epic alliances, epic betrayals, epic battles, epic weddings, epic sex.
Epic sex, I sputtered. By what standards precisely is sex judged to be epic?
And tons of mortal simps like you used as pawns, Bob sighed happily, ignoring my question. There are no words. It was like the Lord of the Rings and all my children made a baby with a Macho Man Randy Savage in a whack-a-mole machine.
Butters sputtered at that image. But, I mean, hell's bells, who wouldn't?
Anyway, he choked out a moment later, the Fomor have a lot of fairy blood in their makeup. I like having Detroit steel around me when I drive.
Murphy said something about the Fomor last night, I said. I take it they've been moving in on the town? His face grew more remote.
Big time. I've been busy.
He exhaled a slow breath.
Look, man, it's really you.
What's left of me, I said tiredly.
Yeah?
He nodded.
There's a problem. With Molly.
I saw, I said.
You didn't see, he said. I mean, I heard that Murphy told you she was a couple bubbles off Plum last night, but there's more than that.
Like what? I asked.
17 people murdered in the past 3 months, he replied in a steady voice.
I didn't say anything for a couple of blocks. Then I said, who?
Scum, he said candidly. Mostly. A cop who is maybe raping a prostitute. Petty criminals, muggers. She doesn't even try to avoid being seen. She's gone totally dark night. Witnesses left and right have reported a tall woman dressed in layers and layers of ragged cast-off clothing. Took the papers about 2 weeks to name her the Rag Lady. People call her various versions, to make fun, to show her they aren't afraid, but...
A lot of people get killed in this town, I said. Doesn't mean it's Molly.
Harry.
Butters stopped at a light and gave me a direct look.
I've examined 12 of the victims. Different manner of death for each of them. But I found them all with a scrap of torn cloth stuffed in their mouths.
So? I demanded.
I matched the cloth. It's the same as what was left of the clothes you wore to Chichen Itza. They had some of it in evidence when they investigated the scene of your murder. Only someone got in there without being seen by anyone or any camera and took it right out.
Memory flashed at me, hard. The silent stone ziggurats in the night. The hiss and rasp of inhuman voices. The stale, reptilian scent of vampires. My fairy godmother... Yes, I'm serious. I have one, and she's freaking terrifying. Had transformed my clothes into protective armor that had probably saved my life half a dozen times that night without my even being aware of it. When they had turned back into my coat, my shirt, and my jeans, there had been little left of them but tatters and scraps. Sort of like me. Someone who had major issues with my death was killing people in my town. Could it be my apprentice? She had a thing for me, according to practically every woman I knew. I didn't have a thing back. Yes, she was gorgeous, intelligent, quick-witted, brave, thoughtful, and competent. But I'd known her when her bra had been a formality, back when I'd begun working with her father,
one of the very few men in the world I hold in genuine respect. There was darkness in Molly. I'd soul-gazed her. I'd seen it in more than one of her possible futures. I'd felt it in the black magic she had worked, with the best of intentions, on fragile, mortal minds. But though she'd fought tooth and nail at Chichen Itza beside the rest of us, she wasn't a killer. Not Molly. Was she? People could be driven to extremes by the right events, the right stakes. I'd bargained away my future and my soul when I had needed to do it to save my daughter. And I was Molly's teacher, her mentor, her example. Had she let herself be driven to extremes at my loss, the way I had been to the potential loss of my daughter? Had she turned aside from everything I'd tried to teach her and let herself slide down into the violent exercise of power? Why shouldn't she have done so, moron? I heard my own voice say in the dark of my thoughts. You showed her how it worked. She's always been an able student. Worse, Molly was a sensitive, a wizard whose supernatural senses were so acute that surges of powerful magic or the emotions that accompanied life and death situations were something that caused her psychic and physical pain. It was something I had barely even considered when I dragged her along to Chichen Itza with me for the largest, most savage, and deadliest brawl I had ever personally participated in. Had the pain of participating in the battle done something to my apprentice? Had it left her with permanent mental damage, just as the gunshot wound she'd received must have left her a permanent scar? Hell. It didn't require any supernatural elements at all for war. And that was what Chichen Itza was, make no mistake, to screw up young soldiers who found themselves struggling to stay alive. Throw in all the mystic menace on top of it, and it started to seem a little bit miraculous that I'd gotten as far as I had while remaining mostly sane. I didn't want to admit it or think about it, but I couldn't deny that it was possible that my apprentice hadn't been as lucky as I had.
"Hey," Butter said quietly. "Harry, you all right?"
"That's kind of subjective, all things considered," I answered. He nodded.
"No one wanted to be the one to tell you the details, but Murphy's pretty sure. She says that if she was still working as a cop, she'd be convinced, and digging as hard as she could to turn up enough evidence to let her put the perp away."
"Yeah," I said quietly. "I get what she means by that." I swallowed. "Why hasn't she?"
"We need Molly," Butter said. "She's made the difference between happily ever after and everyone dying in two raids against the Fomor."
I rubbed my eyes. "Okay, it's something I'll start processing. But I'm not saying that I believe it. Not until I talk to her about it. See her reaction with my own eyes."
"Right,"
Butter said, his voice gentle. I eyed him. "Murphy wouldn't want you telling me this." He shrugged.
"Murphy's not full all the way to the brim herself some days. What she's been doing, it's been hard on her. She's gotten more and more guarded."
"I can imagine." Butters nodded.
"But I've always been kind of a trust-my-instincts guy, and I think you need to know this stuff."
"Thanks," I said. "We've got some other problems, too." His tired, worried face lifted into a sudden grin.
"Of course we do. Harry Dresden is in town."
"What's that?" I put Sir Stuart's pistol into the voluminous pocket of my duster and said, "A cannon. Someone gave it to me."
"Huh."
His voice turned casual.
"Could something like that hurt me?"
I grinned and shook my head.
"Nah,
ghost-on-ghost action only. Assuming I'm able to make it work in the first place." The snow had stopped falling, and Butters turned off his windshield wipers.
"What's it like?"
"What is what like?"
"Being, you know, dead."
He shrugged a shoulder, betraying his discomfort.
"A ghost."
I thought about my answer for a moment. Everything in my body that used to hurt all the time got better. I don't feel hungry or thirsty. Other than that, it feels a lot like being alive, except My magic is gone. And, you know, hardly anyone can see me or hear me.
So the world is the same? He asked.
I shivered. No, it's chock full of all sorts of weird stuff. You wouldn't believe how many ghosts are running around this place. Even as I spoke, I turned my head to watch two wraiths glide down the sidewalk as the car passed them. I frowned. Including one of you, Bob. Bob the Skull snorted.
I'm not mortal. I don't have a soul. The only thing waiting for me when I cease to be is entropy. I can't leave a ghost.
Then how come I saw a floating skull with blue eyelights helping attack Mort Lindquist's place last night? The skull just stared for a moment. Then he suggested lamely.
You were high?
I snorted. Can't be many things like that running around, I said. What do you know?
I have to think about this,
Bob said in a rushed tone, and his orange eyelights winked out. Butters and I both stared at the skull.
Huh, Butters said. I've never seen anyone make him shut up before.
I grunted, then I said quietly, scared the hell out of me seeing that. Thought something had happened to him.
He's fine, Butters said. Best roommate I ever had.
I'm glad you're taking care of him, I said. He wouldn't do well alone.
It's not a big deal, right?
What isn't a big deal?
If there's an evil Bob out there, he said. I mean, it'll just be another nerd like this one, right? Only with a black hat.
The orange eyelights winked back on, and Bob said,
Hey!
Butters, Bob is spooky strong, I said quietly. Knowledge is power, man. Bob has a lot of it. When I accidentally flipped his switch to black hat a few years ago, he nearly killed me in the first 60 seconds. Butters blinked several times. He tried to talk for a few seconds, swallowed, and then said in a small voice,
Oh.
He eyed Bob sideways.
I don't like to make a big thing of it, Sahib,
Bob said easily.
Not really my bag to do that kind of thing anyway.
I nodded. He was created to be an assistant and counselor, I said. It's unprofessional to treat him as anything else.
Which Sahib doesn't, Bob noted, due to complete ignorance, but he doesn't.
Oh, Butters said again. Then he asked,
How do I make sure not to set him on black hat?
You can't, Bob said.
Harry ordered me to forget that part of me and never bring it out again, so I lopped it off.
It was my turn to blink.
You what? Hey, Bob said. You told me never to bring it out again. You said never. As long as I was with you, that wouldn't be an issue. But the next guy could order me to do it, and it would still happen. So I made sure it couldn't happen again. No big whoop, Dresden. Aye, but you're such a little girl sometimes.
I blinked several more times.
Oi? My mother calls me twice a week, Butters explained. He listens in. She's right, you know, Sahib, Bob said brightly. If you'd just do something about your hair and wear nicer clothes, you'd find a woman. You're a doctor, after all. What woman doesn't want to marry a doctor?
Did he just get a little Yiddish accent? I asked Butters.
I get it twice a week already, Bob, Butters growled. I don't need it from you, too. Well, you need it from somewhere, Bob said. I mean, look at your hair.
Butters ground his teeth.
Anyway, Harry,
Bob began. I know, I said. The thing I saw with the gray ghost must be the piece that you cut off.
Right, he said. Got it in one.
Your offspring, one might say. The skull shuddered, which added a lot of motion to the bobblehead thing.
If one was coming from a dementedly limited mortal viewpoint, I guess.
So it's a part of you, but not all of you. It's less powerful. Bob's eyelights narrowed in thought.
Maybe, but the whole of any given being is not always equal to the sum of its parts. Case in point, you.
You aren't working with a lot of horsepower in the brains department, yet you manage to get to the bottom of things sooner than most.
I gave the skull a flat look. Is it stronger than you or not?
I don't know, Bob said. I don't know what it knows. I don't know what it can do. That was sort of the whole point in amputating it. There's a big hole where it used to be.
I grunted.
How big?
Bob rolled his eyes.
Do you want me to tell you in archaic measurements or metric?
Ballpark it.